Hi. I'm going to talk today about reading dyslexia and the brain. So for many years, there's been no way to understand how the brain works without actually invading the brain, either through surgery or through lesions. But very recently, we've gained a number of tools that let us see how the brain works in normal individuals, and particularly these are brain imaging techniques. So these techniques allow us to image both the structure of the human brain and the function of the human brain. And today what I'm going to do is tell you about how these techniques have changed our understanding of how reading works in the brain and what might be going wrong in dyslexia, and then also tell you a little bit about how we might be able to remediate the problems that we see in dyslexia. So there's really three take-home messages to the lecture today. The first is that cognitive neuroscience is still in its infancy. So much of what I tell you today will probably be obsolete in 2 or 3 years, but the techniques that we're developing are going to be those that help us understand these questions long into the future. The second point is that the brain is remarkably plastic. That is, it retains the ability to change with experience, even in adulthood. And third is that the basis of learning disabilities in the brain is multifaceted. There's not going to be a magic bullet to understanding learning disabilities, but these imaging techniques will let us move towards understanding how they work. So first I'm going to give you a short introduction to the brain and then tell you about what we've learned about how language works in the brain and then how reading works in the brain, tell you a little bit about what we know is going on in dyslexia, tell you about work using brain imaging that's looked at brain plasticity and how the brain changes with learning, and then finally show you a little bit of work about how imaging has been used to look at remediation of learning disabilities. Okay, so the human brain is made up of a number of different lobes, and these are shown here in different colors. We understand them very generally in terms of their different functions, and what we want to do then is understand how these are particularly involved in the course of reading. The frontal lobe is going to be an area that we're very interested in. We know that it's engaged in things like motor action, higher thinking. The parietal lobe is engaged in things like touch and spatial sense, but also, as we're going to see in more, it's also engaged in language. The occipital lobe is primarily engaged in processing of vision. The temporal lobe, again, as you're going to see, is very important for language as well as other things like hearing and memory. The brain is made up of two kinds of stuff, basically, what we call gray matter and white matter. So the cells of the brain that are important for processing information are what are called neurons. And neurons are made up of a cell body and then a long tube coming out of them called an axon, which is used to carry information from the cell body down to another neuron down the line. The gray matter is predominantly made up of the cell bodies of the neurons. The white matter is made up of the axons. So you can think of the white matter as sort of like the wiring of the brain. It's sort of hooking together all the different parts of the brain. So we know a little bit about how reading works from studies of normal individuals, reading, learning to read. There's been a ton of work on these sort of things over the last 50 years or so. And the way that we now understand reading is as a relationship between several different types of information processing. One of them is processing what we call orthography. This is the visual features of the word. And these are letters and word features. Phonology is the processing of word sound. This is sort of, you know, how both individual phonemes sound and then how larger words sound. And those two are then related to what we call semantics, which is word meaning, how we understand the meaning of both words and sentences. And most students of reading think that these different processes are sort of highly interconnected. What we really want to do is understand how each of these processes works together in the context of processing of information in the brain. So we want to understand what are the brain regions involved in each of these different processes and how do they work together. So how do we go about mapping cognitive processes onto the brain? Well, for many years, this was done through the study of patients with brain lesions. So what you see here is a brain from a famous patient by Paul Broca. This is the brain of a man who's called Tong. because after he suffered a stroke, which caused the lesion that you see in the frontal cortex, the only word that he could say was tong. And this was the first suggestion that this region, which is now called Broca's area, is important for both language and later on down the road we're going to see for reading as well. But studies of lesions are very difficult. One, because lesions are generally fairly big when they're due to strokes or head injuries. And the scientist has no control over where the lesion occurs. So we're sort of stuck looking at what nature gives us. As I mentioned more recently, brain imaging techniques have been developed that allow us to actually image the normal brain in action. And by comparing different tasks that we think use different cognitive processes, we can try to map particular cognitive processes, in particular those related to reading, onto different regions of the brain. So first, what I'm going to do is tell you about what we know from studies of brain lesions about their effects on language. As I mentioned, Broca's area in the frontal cortex seems to be particularly important for speech production. People with lesions to Broca's area have trouble producing speech. Their speech is very telegraphic, and they often have a very limited number of words that they can say. Another area that was discovered in the 19th century by a German neurologist named Carl Wernicke is now called Wernicke's area, which is in the superior temporal gyrus of the temporal lobe. And this area seems to be particularly important for speech perception. People with damage to this area have trouble understanding spoken speech. They also have trouble relating meaning into the speech that they produce. So they can speak perfectly normal words, but the sentences that they put together don't seem to have much meaning. Another region that seems to be implicated based on lesion studies is the temporal lobe. And the temporal lobe seems to be particularly important for storing the names of objects in the world. So it's been shown that patients with lesions to the temporal lobe have trouble producing the names of various objects. And it seems actually that different parts of the temporal lobe are important for different kinds of names. So there's certain parts of the temporal lobe that are more likely to lead to trouble naming things like tools versus things like objects, or other objects versus things like people. So it seems to be, even within the temporal lobe, segregated such that different areas are important for naming different kinds of objects. Now, this is all lesion work that tells us what happens to spoken language. It turns out that these regions are also very important for understanding reading, because reading is built on top of spoken language. In that, what you have to do when you're learning to read is to take the speech sounds that you hear in language and map them onto these little symbols that are new and that don't really have any evolutionary significance and that differ across different cultures. What we're going to see is that lesions that affect language often affect reading as well. However, there are other regions where lesions can specifically affect language without having more general effects on reading ability. So there was some interesting work at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries by a French neurologist named Desjardin. And what he found, he saw a patient who had two strokes over the course of time. And the first stroke, which this was confirmed by later post-mortem analysis, the first stroke seemed to affect the occipital cortex, which is the very back of the brain. And after this first stroke, the patient had trouble reading, but had no trouble writing. That is, he couldn't read a word, but he could perfectly normally write a word. This is a deficit that's known as alexia without agraphia. Alexia is the inability to read, without agraphia, the inability to write. And this was thought to suggest that the occipital cortex is very important for storing information about the visual aspects of the word. His later stroke, again, this was confirmed after his death by looking at his brain, affected the angular gyrus in the left hemisphere. And what was seen after the second stroke was that he lost the ability to write as well. So then he suffered from alexia with agraphia. And this suggested that the angular gyrus was particularly important for storing information about how words look or how words are shaped apart from different modalities. So regardless of whether it's being written or being read, it seems to store information about the relationship between these visual symbols on the screen and the sounds of language. So that's sort of where things stood in terms of lesion analysis, in terms of studying patients with brain lesions and helping us understand reading. What I want to do now is introduce you to some of the techniques that are used for functional brain imaging and show you how we've learned additional information about how reading works using these techniques. So there's really two different ways that brain imaging measures brain function. There's two different aspects of brain function that are measured, that is. The first is blood flow. And this is measured by techniques including functional MRI, which is the technique that I'm going to focus on in my talk today. Another technique called positron emission tomography, which was one of the first functional brain imaging techniques, but isn't used as much as anymore because it involves administration of radioactive materials. And then there's also a set of new techniques called optical imaging techniques that I'm going to tell you a little bit about that also measure blood flow. The other aspect of brain function that you can measure is electrical activity. And techniques such as electroencephalography, or EEG, and a newer technique called magnetoencephalography, or MEG, both measure electrical activity. In the end, what we really want to do is combine all these. It'll let us understand brain function to its fullest. Now, each of these different types of measures has a different advantage or disadvantage. Measures of blood flow have the ability to, at least in the case of functional MRI, to measure brain activity with very high spatial resolution. So you can say, using functional MRI, where the brain is active within 1 or 2 millimeters at best. The disadvantage of blood flow measures is that the blood flow response, which occurs when the brain becomes active, and this induces an increase in blood flow that I'll describe in a moment, these responses are relatively slow. They occur over the course of 4 to 6 seconds. And so it's difficult to measure very rapid changes in brain activity using these blood flow measures. Electrical measures, on the other hand, have exactly the opposite set of pros and cons. So they're very good at measuring the temporal aspects of processing. We can measure things down to the nearest millisecond, but they're not particularly good at localizing where that activity is going on in the brain. Okay, so here's the idea about how functional brain imaging techniques work, particularly those that are involved in measuring of blood flow. So when a person engages in a cognitive process, they see the word bird and they think of the object bird. This causes firing of neurons in particular parts of the brain. And for reasons that are only starting to be understood, whenever neurons begin firing in the brain, there's increased blood flow to that particular area of the brain. And it turns out that the brain actually sends more new, fresh, oxygenated blood than is actually needed. So there's an overflow of oxygenated blood in the particular areas that are active. Functional MRI takes advantage of this by using particular MRI techniques that are sensitive to the amount of oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. And so by looking for regions where the amount of oxygenated blood goes up during performance of various cognitive tasks, we can determine which brain areas are involved in those tasks. So the way that we do this is we have the subject perform multiple tasks. We know that brain activity leads to blood flow. And what we do is try to set up the different tasks that the subject performs such that we think they differ in a particular cognitive process. So, for example, I could present you the word nail on the screen and ask you to just read the word nail aloud, or I could present you the word nail on the screen and ask you to generate a verb that is associated with that word. So you might say hammer. And using these kinds of differences, we can isolate cognitive processes. In this case, we think we isolate the cognitive process of actually retrieving semantic information from memory, retrieving information about meaning. That's something that's necessary in the verb generation task, but not necessary in simply reading the word. And so by looking at the difference between these tasks, we can isolate brain regions associated with cognitive performance. So an example of how functional MRI works is shown here. This is a task in which a subject alternated between two different tasks, and the whole time we were scanning using functional MRI, taking one scan about every 3 seconds. So we look how activity changes over the course of every 3 seconds. So the blue line in the graph that you see shows you activity go in one particular area of the brain. This is in the left hemisphere in the auditory cortex, going up and down. As the subject either simply rested, hearing only the noise of the MRI scanner, or they heard spoken syllables and had to decide whether they were ba or da or wa. And so you see in the graph, the areas with the red bars at the bottom are the area, are the points in time where the subject was hearing the word spoken. The areas where there are no red bars are the parts of time where the subject was simply hearing the scanner noise. And what you can see is that as the speech starts, whenever each of the red bars occurs, activity goes up. Now, it's bumpy, and these are fMRI data have a lot of noise in them, so we have to use statistical techniques to actually find which areas of the brain are showing this up-down pattern. But you can see, very systematically, every time the red bar occurs, activity goes up. So using these statistical techniques, what we can then do is find regions of the brain that show significant activity related to this change in task. And this is shown here in the slice on the right, where the regions that are colored in are those that were significantly more active during hearing of speech sounds than during rest. So these are the kind of techniques that we use in functional MRI. Now, everybody wants to know about MRI's safety. Now, certainly in comparison to previous techniques, it's very safe. It involves no injections, there's no ionizing radiation or x-rays involved. But at the same time, it's never possible to prove that that anything is perfectly safe, because something could always happen down the road that would suggest that it isn't. However, there's no evidence of long-term side effects to MRI exposure, and we currently scan children down to the age of, I think, 7. The one difficulty in scanning children is that it requires them to sit still for 40 to 50 minutes, and it requires them to be very still for periods of 5 or 6 minutes at a time. And this can be difficult for even the most well-behaved child. So what I want to do now is tell you what we've learned from some imaging studies of reading, and particularly with respect to these different component processes of reading. Now, remember that the early studies by Dejerine had suggested that the occipital cortex was very important for the processing of the visual aspects of language. And imaging studies have confirmed this. In particular, they pointed to both the occipital cortex and to a region called the fusiform gyrus, which is a long gyrus that follows along the bottom of the brain that you see imaged here in yellow. This is projected on the bottom of the brain. And both of these regions seem to be active when people perform tasks that require processing of orthographic information, that is, of letter or word forms, compared to processing other kinds of information. For example, processing of letters from alphabets that they don't know, or processing of what are called false fonts, which are things that look like alphabets, but they're not real alphabets. So these data seem to have confirmed the importance of those regions from the early lesion studies. Now, looking at phonology in the brain, what we see is that there's a set of regions that seem to be important for phonology. First is the inferior frontal cortex, what I referred to previously as Broca's area. In addition, there are regions in the posterior part of the brain that seem to be involved in phonology. These include the inferior part of the parietal cortex, as well as the temporal cortex, both the superior temporal cortex, the part that I refer to as Wernicke's area, and the more inferior parts of the temporal cortex, which also seem to be important for processing phonological aspects of written words. One very interesting thing is when you look at the regions that seem to be involved in semantic processing in the brain, there's actually a great deal of overlap between those regions and the ones involved in processing phonology. Again, the inferior frontal cortex is important, the inferior parietal cortex, and the temporal cortex, though there seem to be some differences in the extent of those areas. In particular, there's parts of the inferior frontal cortex at the very sort of front of that part of the brain that seem to be more strictly involved in semantic processing and not involved in phonological processing. But overall, there's a whole lot of overlap between these things, suggesting that that the brain is using very similar neural networks to do both of these processes. Now, all the data that I've shown you so far have come from techniques like functional MRI that basically look at large slices of time, say 3 seconds at a time. But we know that a person can read a word in several hundred milliseconds and that there's processing that goes on in the brain very quickly over that period of time. So techniques such as MEG have been used to look at how brain processing changes very quickly. And what I'm going to show you here is a movie. This is on what you see on the slide is an inflated brain surface. So as I think I showed you before, the brain is really like a raisin. It's sort of crumpled up, and there's actually a large amount of surface area that's fitted down into the folds, which are called the sulci of the brain. Using computational techniques, one can actually inflate an image of the brain such that you take the raisin and turn it back into the grape and then show brain activity rendered on that inflated surface. So you can actually see all of the brain and you don't miss the parts that are sort of buried down in the sulci. What I'm going to show you is brain activity over the course of about, I think, 800 milliseconds changing as the subject reads a word. And so you'll see activity starting in the back of the brain and then moving forward. And another interesting thing to notice is that after about 300 milliseconds, you can see that activity actually sort of goes back and forth between the frontal and the more posterior parts of the brain, which suggests that even in the course of a very short period of time, there's a lot of brain activity going on in relation to reading. What this tells us is that if we really want to understand how the brain reads, we need to combine the techniques like functional MRI with techniques like MEG or EEG, which will let us understand both aspects. And there's a number of groups that are very interested in doing that right now. Okay, so one thing that we've learned from the study of reading is that there seem to be multiple ways that one can read a word. And this has been most strongly promoted in what's called a dual root model of reading. The idea is that you can read a word in two different ways. One is that you can look at the word and use what we call orthographic to phonologic translation rules or conversion rules to basically take each particular letter, turn it into its appropriate sound, and then put it back together. So you can pronounce lock by saying l-a-k and then putting those all together into lock. Another way that one might read is to have actually memorized that the letters L-O-C-K go with the sound lock and just directly retrieve that whole sound. Now, direct retrieval is interesting because it's the only way to properly read what we call irregular words. And these are words that don't follow the standard rules of orthographic to phonologic convergence, like yacht, which by the rules you would pronounce yacht, or pint, which by the rules you would pronounce pint. The only way to learn to read these is by direct retrieval. And so people have been very interested in understanding what are the brain systems that are involved in either phonological translation or direct retrieval. And it's been suggested that there seem to be two routes from orthography to sound, there's two routes going through the brain for reading. There's a direct retrieval route, which seems to follow sort of the low road through the temporal lobe and then up to the frontal cortex. And then there's a phonological recoding route that seems to follow the high road from occipital cortex up through the parietal lobe and then to frontal cortex. And this has been shown very nicely in a study that compared English and Italian readers. Now, an interesting thing about Italian is it has no irregular words. All the words follow the orthographic to phonologic translation rules. So looking at brain regions that differed between English and Italian readers when they read various words, Aroldo Palsu and his colleagues in Italy found that there were differences in the brain regions that are active. In particular, the English readers seem to activate the more inferior root in the temporal cortex, whereas the Italian readers seem to activate the more posterior root in the parietal cortex. And this fits with the idea that the Italians, because there are no irregular words in Italian, the Italians would be more likely to, by default, use the orthographic phonologic translation rules, whereas the English readers would be more likely to use the direct retrieval route. Okay. So I told you a little bit about how we think reading works in the normal brain. What I want to do now is tell you what we think is going on in the brains of kids who have trouble learning to read. And this is a sizable portion of the population, at least. It's estimated somewhere between, somewhere around 5% of kids, at least, have trouble learning to read. And we now have several bits of evidence that suggest that there are neurological problems that seem to lead to at least some of these reading troubles. So first, some very interesting work by Dr. Al Galliberta at the Beth Israel Medical Center in Boston has shown, using postmortem studies of a small number of people who had dyslexia and then went on to die, that that their brains have pathologic features. And so what you see here in the left inset is what's called a cortical ectopia. This is a malformation, a microscopic malformation in the cerebral cortex that seems to occur in the brains of these dyslexics and are very rarely, if ever, found in the brains of normal reading individuals. And the figure on the right shows the distribution over a number of individuals of where those cortical malformations occur, suggesting that these individuals do have specific brain abnormalities that may be leading to their reading problems. The difficulty with these postmortem studies, of course, is that you don't know as much as you would like to know about the individuals who actually died. So you can't say specifically that these are related to dyslexia and not perhaps some other problems that they had. Now, we've used functional MRI to examine how the brain processes information in dyslexic children. Now, a number of studies have been done looking at brain processing in dyslexic adults using functional MRI. And these studies have primarily suggested that the angular gyrus in the left hemisphere is less active when dyslexic readers either read or process phonological information compared to normal readers. The problem with studying adult dyslexics is that they've been trying to read for many years, and many of them develop complex compensatory strategies that help them go on to be able to at least get by reading. And so we wanted to examine how children from age 8 to 12 who haven't had many years of learning compensatory strategies, how the activity in the dyslexic children's brains differ from normal children. So the way that we did this was to bring kids into the MR scanner and have them perform three different tasks. In one task, which we call the rhyme letters task, shown here, the kids were told, okay, we're going to have you now, you're going to see two letters, and what we want you to do is tell us if the names of those letters rhyme. So if you see TD, you would say yes. If you see GK, you would say no. They have to do another task where they see two letters, and instead of saying whether they rhyme, they just say whether they're the same letter. So for the letters DM, they would say no. For the letters PP, they would say yes. And while they're inside the scanner, they have a projector that's projecting the letters to them, and they're pressing a button to make their response, so we know how accurate and how fast they are. A third task was one in which they simply saw two lines and had to say whether those lines had the same orientation. So if they're both pointed this way, they would say yes. If they're pointed like that, they would say no. And what we saw was that the dyslexic kids seemed to be about as good as the normal kids at doing the match letters and match lines task, but they were significantly worse at performing the rhyming task, which is consistent with the phonological impairments that are often seen in dyslexia. Looking at brain activity, what we saw was that there were significant differences between the normal reading children and the dyslexic children. In particular, as was found in the adult studies of dyslexia, we saw that the dyslexic kids had less activity in the parietal cortex. This is this spot in the back of the brain that's active in the normal reading children, not active in the dyslexic children. Now, one perennial problem in these sort of studies is that you often get groups that aren't matched on IQ. And in fact, the full groups of dyslexic and control children that we scanned indeed were not matched on IQ. The normal reading children have higher IQ. What we did was sub-selected a group of those normal reading children in order to equate IQ so that we can be sure that these differences didn't have to do with general intelligence rather than reading ability specifically. And what you see is that those differences still remain, that the normal children show more activity in the inferior parietal cortex near the angular gyrus than do the dyslexic children. So we think that one very general feature of dyslexia is dysfunction of the angular gyrus, very consistent with what we saw before in terms of the lesion studies. Now, it turns out that there are a number of other different types of processing that appear to be impaired in dyslexia. One of these is what we call dynamic auditory processing. And this is processing of very rapidly changing sounds. We're talking about sounds that change on the order of tens of milliseconds. The reason that this kind of processing is important is because much of the important information in speech is obtained from sounds that, from contrast between sounds that change that rapidly. For example, the difference between ba and pa has to do with a very small difference in the timing of particular sounds. Now, what we've shown using functional MRI is that not only are dyslexic individuals impaired at processing these kind of sounds and making decisions about rapidly changing sounds, but they also show different brain activity for the processing of rapid versus slowly changing sounds. And this is seen in this slide. These are regions in the frontal lobe that seem to be more active when control subjects, normal reading controls, hear rapid sounds versus hearing slowly changing sounds. We don't see those same differences in dyslexics. I'll come back and show you later that we think we can probably change the brain such that those differences start to appear. Another aspect of brain processing that seems to be impaired in dyslexia is what we call functional connectivity. Now, I told you that the brain is sort of all wired up together by the white matter, and different parts of the brain talk to each other, and that was sort of obvious from the graph over time from the MEG, where you see the different parts of the brain activity bouncing around. Clearly, there's a lot of communication going on there. One thing that seems to be happening in dyslexia is that the angular gyrus, whereas in normal subjects it's heavily interconnected to other regions, and its activity seems to co-vary with activity of other regions. In dyslexics, you don't see that sort of co-variation, and in fact, people have suggested that the angular gyrus is functionally disconnected, that not only doesn't it seem to show the same amount of activity, but it doesn't seem to talk to other regions in the same way as it does in normal individuals. Now, one way that this might occur is through problems in the white matter. So, as I mentioned, the white matter is sort of the wiring of the brain. It's these little tubes that are covered with this insulation material called myelin, and that's why the white matter is white, and that they sort of carry information from one part of the brain to the other, you know, across long distances and across relatively short distances. It's also what lets your brain talk to your hand when you move your hand. Now, very recently, a technique has been developed called diffusion tensor imaging, which lets us actually image white matter in the living brain. And it does this using a very clever technique by measuring the movement of water. It turns out that when water moves by what's called Brownian motion, and atoms just sort of move around randomly, if they're just in an unstructured medium in the middle of a big glass of water, an atom is going to sort of go any direction at once. On average, they're just going to go in any direction. They're not going to have a preferred direction. But if you put a bunch of water molecules inside a very thin tube, what's going to happen is that they're going to bounce off the walls of the tube, and they're going to be more likely to move in the direction through the tube than they are through the walls. And this is particularly the case because this stuff called myelin that's on the outside of the axons is basically waterproof. Water really doesn't like myelin, so it's going to just sort of move down the axon instead. We can measure this using this technique called diffusion tensor MRI. So what you see here in this slide is an image of the brain showing where the white matter is, and then this little inset in the yellow box shows where the direction of the white matter axon. So the little red lines show what direction are these white matter axons pointing. In this case, we're looking at a slice through the corpus callosum, and we see that they're pointing from the left to the right. And in other parts of the brain, you can see that they point in other directions. This is seen here using a color coding, where we basically code each different part of the brain in terms of which direction the axons are pointing. So what you see on the left here is just a slice through the middle of the brain like this. And the regions shown in yellow are regions where the axons are pointing up, down. And so the IC points to the internal capsule, which is the thing that lets your motor cortex talk to your hand and the rest of your body. The regions shown in blue are those that point left-right. So, for example, you see that in the corpus callosum, in the frontal cortex. And then the regions in red are those that point front-back. And those are going to be the ones that we're most interested in because they allow the frontal cortex to talk to the parietal cortex to talk to the occipital cortex. Now, we used diffusion tensor imaging to look at whether there are differences in dyslexic and normal individuals in how their white matter was structured. And what we saw was that the white matter structure was weaker in dyslexia compared to the normal individuals. And so this is a single slice through the brain on the top here, and then going down in with the slices of color coding show you the differences, the regions where there are differences between dyslexic and normal individuals in how well the white matter is structured. And it could well be that it has to do with differences in myelination, but we don't know that yet because there are a number of different factors in the white matter that affect this diffusion tensor technique. Now, one very interesting thing we saw in this study was when we looked across both groups, we saw that this measure called anisotropy, which is a measure of how strongly the white matter points in a single direction, differed between dyslexics and controls. We also saw that it correlated with reading ability, and this is just reading score on a standard single-word reading test. What was very interesting is that even within the control group, these are individuals who weren't chosen to have any reading problems, just taken off the street, we saw a significant correlation between anisotropy, that is, white matter structure, and reading ability. So what this suggests is that even related to normal variation in reading ability, there may be differences in white matter. Now, the one thing that we can't claim is which direction the causality is going, because we all know that correlation doesn't equal causation. It could be the case that you're born with white matter of a certain type, and that determines how well you're going to read. Alternatively, it could be the case that reading actually changes your white matter, and we're very interested in understanding which direction the arrow is pointing there. Okay, I mentioned another technique called optical brain imaging. What I want to do now is tell you a little bit about that technique, because we're very excited about being able to use it to understand reading and language processes in very young children. The way optical imaging works is that it measures blood flow using light. So if you can imagine sticking a laser pointer to your finger and shining it and looking at the light that comes through, that's basically what optical imaging does. It transmits light and then looks at what comes back, and it turns out that oxygenated versus deoxygenated blood differentially reflect different wavelengths of light. The great thing about this technique is that it works well in very young children, from newborn up to about 5 years of age, because their skulls are relatively thin. It works in adults as well, but it's harder because we have big, thick skulls. And it's extremely safe. It's no more dangerous than shining a flashlight through your hand. So just as an example of this, these are actually data from Ellen Grant and David Boaz at Mass General Hospital, showing activity in a newborn related to presentation of light. So recording optical imaging over the occipital cortex, they show the baby a flash of light, and then they look at brain activity change over that time. And what you see is that starting out, green means there's no activation, and then the areas shown in red are the occipital cortex regions that show greater activation over time. And what this tells us is that we can use this technique to image brain activity even in newborns and certainly in very young children as well. And so that's going to be one of the techniques that we go on to use extensively in the future to try to understand reading as it, particularly as processes change when children are learning to read. The problem being that as children who are very young start learning to read, we won't be able to perform functional MRI on them because they're not going to be able to sit still long enough for us to actually collect the proper data. Okay, what I want to do now is move on to the second point that I wanted to make, which is that the brain is remarkably plastic, and both following brain injury and just associated with learning new skills, the brain changes continuously. So what I first want to do is tell you about sort of a worst case scenario. This is a case study of a woman who I'll call E.H. She was born and seemed to be a normal right-handed child. At the age of 12, she started developing seizures related to a disorder that's called Rasmussen's encephalitis, which for some reason seems to predominantly affect one hemisphere of the brain, leaving the other one relatively intact. And at age 16, because these seizures could not be controlled medically, they performed a radical surgery, which is called a hemispherectomy, where her entire left hemisphere was removed. Now, what we know in almost all right-handed individuals is that the left hemisphere is predominantly important for language in those individuals. That most of the processes involved in language live in the left hemisphere. So as you might imagine, when she had her left hemisphere removed, she had a ton of troubles with language. She had been having troubles with language even before that because of the seizures. But what's remarkable is that even though she didn't speak for several months after surgery, she's now able to both speak and even read simple words. What you see here is an MRI showing you the amount of brain that was removed, and you can see that it was extensive. Basically, it was almost the entire left hemisphere, and the part of the left hemisphere that wasn't removed was actually disconnected, so it's basically sitting there doing nothing. It's not really connected to anything. We use functional MRI to look at how the intact right hemisphere in EH processes language. So we had her do several things in the scanner, such as listening to words or making semantic judgments, such as deciding whether particular things were either living or non-living objects. She was able to do these tasks relatively well, and what we saw was the regions in the right hemisphere that were active seemed to be mirror images of those that we would expect to be active in the left hemisphere of normal individuals who are right-handed. So what this suggests is that the right hemisphere basically takes over the function that the left hemisphere would usually support in an individual who didn't have half of their brain diseased. So what this is sort of the strongest example that one might find of brain plasticity, where one whole hemisphere takes over the function of another. We've been interested in more mundane examples of skill learning as well, and one particular task we've been interested in is what's called the mirror reading task. And this is a task in which people are presented with mirror-reversed text. So in this case, you'd see the words, and the subject would say, ambitious, bedraggled, plaintiff. And with practice, people can get very good at this. What we've done is taken college students, teach them to read mirror-reversed text for roughly about 5 hours, and then look at how brain activity changes from before training to after training. And what we see is that many parts of the brain are active when people do these tasks. These are plots showing you, or figures showing you, brain activity both before learning and after learning, and in particular showing you the regions that show learning-related increases. That is, they become more active after the person has learned the skill and has gotten much better at it than they were before. And we see increases in very interesting areas, both the frontal cortex on the left hemisphere and the inferior temporal cortex, regions that we think are involved in processing of both semantic and phonological information in the frontal cortex and orthographic and these other types of information as well in the temporal cortex. So what this shows is that even with 5 hours of training, we can induce plasticity in the brain. This is an example from a single individual showing that before learning, they showed very little activation in the left inferior temporal cortex, which is the area that's circled in the top set of brains. And they showed extensive activation in the right parietal cortex, which is the area circled on the bottom set of brains. And then after learning, you see this switch around, such that there's increased activity in the inferior temporal cortex, decreased activity in the parietal cortex. So what this suggests is that regions are actually changing their engagement as skill is acquired. We call this process switching, that you actually change which parts of the brain are engaged. Now, it's been suggested that the same principles that sort of drive plasticity in normal individuals could actually be used to remediate language deficits. And particularly this is based on the theory that the deficit in dyslexia is derived from these problems that I mentioned in what we call dynamic auditory processing, processing of very rapidly changing auditory information. So a training program has been developed called Fast Forward, which is designed to train the processing of rapidly successive auditory signals or sounds using both language stimuli by running a language through an algorithm that both slows it down and amplifies the rapidly changing parts, and using non-language stimuli as well. And by sort of adaptively, by starting out very easy and adaptively getting better, the idea is that you improve processing of these kinds of information, and thus down the road, you should be able to improve language and reading as well. The analogy that's been used is glasses for the ears, that you improve the ability to hear certain types of sounds, and then later down the road you'll be better at learning to do other things that require that type of process. So we did a pilot study of three adults with history of dyslexia going through this fast forward training program. Now, the training program was initially designed for children, and it's since been predominantly tested on children. But we wanted to see, even in adults, can we change brain processing using this technique? So we used exactly the same games that are used for the children with specific language impairment, which is the initial group of children who were studied using this task. This shows you data from these three subjects on a task that involves processing of brief successive tones. So what they do is they hear three sounds in a row, like beep, boop, beep, and they have to say whether each sound was high or low. So they would say for that one, high, low, high. And what we saw was that each of the subjects got better at doing the task. Normal subjects need about 50 milliseconds in between the sounds to actually perform the task relatively well, let's say 80% accuracy. Two of these subjects BA and WM, were much worse than normals starting out. They needed at least 150 milliseconds between these sounds in order to accurately say whether each sound was high or low. What we saw after training is that all these subjects got better, and the two who were particularly bad got much better at performing this test, suggesting that they were able to learn to process this information more rapidly. What we see when we use brain imaging is that for those two subjects who got much better at processing rapidly changing information, they both showed increased activity in the frontal cortex, very near the region where we had previously seen the difference between dyslexic and normal individuals. They showed increased activation for processing rapidly changing sounds versus slowly changing sounds. One way to think of this is what we've done is made their brains look a little more normal. Now, this is a very preliminary data set with only three individuals, and we're currently doing extensive studies looking at this in children. I think very soon down the road we should have much better ideas about what kinds of changes are invoked in the brain in relation to this kind of remediation effort. What we saw in these adults was that training resulted in improved speech perception. When we tested their speech perception down the road, we didn't see that it resulted in consistent improvements in reading right away. And the idea is that simply training people to hear better is not going to teach them to read. That once you've done that, then you have to go teach them to read, and they should be better set up to learn to read down the road. And that's a hypothesis that remains to be tested. There's two ongoing studies right now, one at Stanford and one in our lab at Mass General, that are looking at children going through fast forward and examining various aspects of brain processing using functional MRI. Our pilot data suggest that fast forward training may result in differential activation of the parietal cortex as well. Now, remember that we saw that the angular gyrus and more generally the inferior parietal cortex seems to be underactivated in children with dyslexia. What you see here is data from a single child, both pre-fast forward and post-fast forward, while this child was doing a speech perception task. This is listening to speech sounds and making decisions about those speech sounds. You see that she initially showed no activation in the parietal cortex near the blue arrow, but she did show some activation in the frontal cortex. After fast-forward training, she showed activation in a number of regions in the parietal and temporal cortex. And again, this is very preliminary data, but it suggests that we may start to see changes in the activation of these usually active in normal subjects' brain regions. Okay, so in conclusion, what I've told you is, one, there's a large set of brain regions that seem to be important for language, and then the areas that are important for reading include those areas important for language, but then there's also additional areas that seem to be particularly important for reading specifically, and those include the angular gyrus and the occipital and inferior temporal cortex. Neural processing in at least some of these regions seems to be disrupted in dyslexia. I've shown you evidence both from normal individuals and from individuals with brain injury that the adult brain can exhibit remarkable plasticity. It can change greatly over the course of relatively small periods of time. And what we hope is that we can use this plasticity to remediate brain-based learning disabilities, even in adulthood. Thanks.